facility. In the coming months, NCTC Director Matt Olson and I briefed what happened that night again and again to all our congressional oversight committees and several of the eight congressional investigations. In the course of all those briefings, I became intimately familiar with the consolidated intelligence picture of what we knew, what we thought, and what we didn't know. At about 9:40 p.m., a group of men, some affiliated with Ansar al-Sharia and some armed, pushed past the main gate of the compound and ran into it, firing guns into the air. The local militia that had been hired as guards immediately fled or dropped their weapons, or both. On the security tapes I've seen, the invaders run right past the building in which most of the Americans are hiding, gleefully skipping around the compound. They don't hunt for hostages. They don't secure diplomatic materials or posts. They don't take up military positions to secure the compound. Instead, they start looting and vandalizing, spray-painting graffiti and stealing Xboxes, clothes, and anything of value they can find. One guy is seen running out of a building with a bottle of ketchup. Other random people stroll in through the gate, joking around or trying to take part in the looting while they could. At some point, the intruders stumble onto cans of gasoline beside a generator. They spread the gasoline around and light the main building on fire. As soon as they realized there had been a security breach, Chris Stevens, Information Management Officer Sean Smith, and a security officer locked themselves in a safe room in the main building. When looters couldn't break into the room, they moved on to areas more easily accessed. The Americans were safe until the building was set on fire, at which point the security officer said they needed to leave. He became separated from Chris and Sean as they evacuated, and, after reaching safety, went back in for them several times, diving through windows with black smoke pouring out. Calls for help went out from the compound to other local militias, who served as security from time to time. None of them responded, either because they didn't want to incite a militia turf war, as some claimed, or because Ansar al-Sharia had placed its own calls to other militias, claiming the ongoing riot had started because the Americans had fired on protesters at the gate. Accounts vary. Either way, help was not forthcoming from the militias. However, there was a small, covert CIA compound half a mile away that did respond. The CIA operatives geared up, armed themselves, and were ready to go within 5 or 10 minutes, and then waited another 5 or 10 minutes while their boss was on the phone and radio trying to determine precisely what kind of situation he was sending his men into. Those minutes must have been agonizing. Finally, they boarded 2 trucks and headed out the gate of the CIA annex just 20 or 25 minutes after the gate of the State Department facility was first stormed, and 18 minutes after they'd been notified. Knowing they would be outmanned and outgunned, they stopped several times, either in an attempt to recruit formerly friendly militia members to join them, or to avoid those appearing hostile. It took 30 minutes to travel a little more than a mile, and they were unable to enlist any help. The handful of CIA officers hit the compound as hard as they could, exchanging gunfire and scattering the looters. They quickly rallied the State Department security officers and began to search for Chris Stevens and Sean Smith, the only 2 people not accounted for. They found Sean inside the main building, having succumbed to smoke inhalation, but couldn't locate Chris. After about an hour of searching, they came under gunfire again. Recognizing they could be overwhelmed quickly and that they were unlikely to find Chris alive, the CIA and State Department officers all left to return to the CIA annex. It was then about 11:30, not quite 2 hours after the incident began. When the Americans left, the looting and vandalism resumed. At some point, a few of the Libyans came across Chris, who had also succumbed to smoke. They rushed him to a hospital where he was pronounced dead. At around 10:30, Benghazi time, less than an hour after the gate was breached and about when the CIA annex team was reaching the State Department facility, the first word of what was happening in Libya reached Washington, where it was approximately 4:30 in the afternoon. At 5 p.m., Washington time, as the CIA team in Benghazi was searching the State Department facility for Chris Stevens and Sean Smith, President Obama met with Leon Panetta, who'd replaced Bob Gates as Secretary of Defense, and JCS Chairman General Marty Dempsey, a meeting that had been previously scheduled. At that point, buildings at the State Department facility were on fire, but the gunfire had stopped, and it seemed that the attack was over. The president and his two top DOD leaders discussed options for military intervention if violence resumed or escalated. Back in the Pentagon after the meeting with the president, Leon would order special operations teams to stage in Italy and Spain and be ready to go. I was at a dinner banquet to receive an award from an industry association when my security detail pulled me aside to take an urgent phone call from Matt Olson. I knew there had been a series of demonstrations across the Islamic world that day, related to the release on YouTube of an amateurish film that mocked the Prophet Muhammad, the founder of Islam. With all the terrible content out there on the internet, I will never understand how this particular YouTube video gained so much traction and caused so much unrest. The U.S. Embassy in Cairo had been overrun by protesters of the film who'd hauled down and burned the U.S. flag and vandalized the facility. The CIA had warned the American ambassador in Cairo of the impending protest, and she had evacuated the embassy, so while there had been some damage, no one had been hurt. Thinking the phone call might be related to that incident, I stepped away to take it. Matt told me that a U.S. diplomatic facility in Benghazi had been attacked, and that Chris Stevens was missing. That was all the information he had at the time. I recalled my meeting with Chris just 4 months earlier, and I wondered what in the world he was doing in Benghazi on the anniversary of 9/11, while anti-American protests were taking place all over the Middle East. Matt said he'd update me if he received more substantial information, but I didn't hear from him again that night. Around midnight in Benghazi, the CIA team arrived back at their annex just as a group of attackers began shooting there. They took cover and returned fire. Over the next hour, they intermittently exchanged fire with unknown parties. The shooting stopped about 1 a.m. on Wednesday, September 12th. Soon after that, a CIA security team from Tripoli, composed of 6 former special operations troops, including former Navy SEALs Glenn Doherty and Tyrone Woods, landed in Benghazi. Heavily armed and on foot, they had no way to get to the CIA annex from the airport. Over the next several hours, they tried to cajole or bribe local militias to take them there. Finally, they persuaded someone with a few trucks to give them a ride, and they reached the annex about 5 a.m. Doherty and Woods took up sniper positions on the roof just as a mortar attack commenced. The first 2 shells missed the building, but the final 3 hit the roof, killing both of them. With the Americans pinned down, the attackers simply left. We don't know precisely why they did so, although I agree with the theory former CIA acting director Michael Morell offered in his account of the Benghazi attack. The attackers probably just happened to have only 5 mortar shells and left after firing them all. That morning, the Americans left Benghazi for Tripoli, and the 4 deceased Americans, along with several wounded, were flown out of Libya later in the day. The response teams Secretary Panetta had ordered to prepare couldn't reach Libya before the fighting was over, although a Marine Corps counterterrorism unit did make it to Tripoli later that day. This narrative describes essentially what took place in Benghazi on September 11th and 12th. Others have published much more detailed accounts of that night, notably David Kirkpatrick in his series A Deadly Mix in Benghazi in the New York Times, and Michael Morell in his book, The Great War of Our Time. What I've outlined is the consensus intelligence view of the events of that night, which we have compelling physical evidence to back up, including video from the Predator, from security cameras, and from the cell phones of looters and vandals, including a recording of Chris Stevens being pulled from the burning building and the efforts to save him. While we have a great deal of information about the incident now, it's very important to me to note that we knew very little immediately after the attack. On Wednesday, I saw a trickle of information reporting that there had been a series of firefights at the State Department facility and at the CIA annex, identifying who had been injured and who had died, and the security implications of what had been left behind in Benghazi. The first real intelligence analysis attempting to assemble a coherent narrative indicated that there had been a protest outside the State Department facility, similar to the one that had overrun the Cairo embassy, and that extremist elements within the group had, with little or no planning, used the event as an opportunity to attack the facility. As it turned out, there had been no protest in Benghazi. In the years since then, many have asked how we could have gotten that point wrong. Avoiding citing classified sources, I would direct them to Kirkpatrick's series, in which he notes that some of the people who'd actually been doing the looting and vandalizing that night had believed the whole incident started as a protest outside the gate. 2 decades before all of this took place, when General Colin Powell was JCS chairman, he famously advised his intelligence briefers, "Tell me what you know. Tell me what you don't know. Then tell me what you think. Always distinguish which is which." If we fell short in briefing the White House and our oversight committees in Congress on what had occurred, it was as a result of failing to heed that advice, particularly when it came to our analysis that the attack had begun as a protest. That was definitely something we thought, not something we knew. Also, in my interactions with senators and representatives in the days after the attack, I reported that our analysis was based on the first reports, and first reports are never entirely accurate. On Thursday, David Petraeus, who'd succeeded Leon Panetta as CIA director, briefed the Senate Intelligence Committee in a closed-door, classified session, and on Friday morning, September 14th, he briefed the House Intelligence Committee. The House committee asked him if CIA could put together a set of unclassified talking points that they could use for the Sunday news shows over the weekend, which he agreed to have the agency prepare. Washington is a strange place. I can't help but wonder how it would have changed the course of U.S. history if Dave had counteroffered, "We won't write talking points, but if your staff writes something, we'll check it for facts and classification." I didn't become aware of the talking points until Saturday, when the CIA sent them around for interagency coordination with State Department, DOD, my office, and others. My gut feeling was that the IC's offering any talking points for politicians was a mistake. For us to tell them what they should say about the attack, and how they should say it, was crossing the line of intelligence's leaving the business of policymaking to the policymakers. But I judged that by Saturday afternoon, when congressional and public affairs offices in different cabinet departments and the White House were already squabbling over nuances like whether the State Department facility was a consulate or a diplomatic post, it was too late to gracefully retract Dave's promise to provide something to Congress. That was a mistake on my part. In the end, the IC consensus for the talking points was short and simple. The currently available information suggests that the demonstrations in Benghazi were spontaneously inspired by the protests at the U.S. Embassy in Cairo and evolved into a direct assault against the U.S. diplomatic post and subsequently its annex. There are indications that extremists participated in the violent demonstrations. This assessment may change as additional information is collected and analyzed and currently available information continues to be evaluated. The investigation is ongoing, and the U.S. government is working with Libyan authorities to help bring to justice those responsible for the deaths of U.S. citizens. The following morning, I turned the TV on and found that it wasn't just the House Intelligence Committee members who were using the talking points on Sunday morning shows. Susan Rice, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, who everyone presumed was going to replace Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, was also relying on them. I wasn't even aware that Susan had received an intelligence briefing on what had occurred. she hadn't. On each of the shows, she discussed how opportunistic extremist elements had taken over a protest at the Benghazi facility gate in what was initially a spontaneous reaction to what had just transpired hours before in Cairo. She spoke of protests throughout the Middle East, saying, "This is a response to a hateful and offensive video that was widely disseminated throughout the Arab and Muslim world." I watched Susan's appearances with growing unease. It was true that everything she said reflected what we believed at the time. While the talking points from the CIA didn't mention the YouTube video, they did say that the demonstration in Benghazi was a spontaneous reaction to the Cairo protest, which was indisputably a response to the detestable video. Susan's grasp of what the CIA had provided was fine. In fact, her presentation didn't bother me at all. What did bother me was the context. It was less than 2 months before Election Day, and President Obama's campaign had been pushing very hard to argue that his policy decisions had led to significant progress against al-Qaeda, while his opponent was claiming that the president was soft on terrorism. Within hours of the attack, Mitt Romney, the Republican nominee for president, had accused President Obama of responding to the Benghazi attack by apologizing for the video, mistakenly referencing a statement from the Cairo embassy condemning it, hours before protests had occurred there. His facts were incorrect, but they fit the narrative, and so the accusation was effective politically. Wearing my DNI hat, I would observe that the truth regarding the global terrorism threat in 2012 was complicated. Years of drone strikes and commando raids had decimated al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, and the bin Laden raid had provided us with valuable intelligence that the CIA and Defense Department had exploited to put the network that remained on the decline. But the ideology that al-Qaeda exemplified didn't need bin Laden or even al-Qaeda itself to spread. The same unrest and instability that had led to the Arab Spring had provided al-Qaeda franchises, many other al-Qaeda affiliates, and even more militant groups inspired by al-Qaeda, plenty of impressionable potential recruits. Worse, the Arab Spring had deposed many of the fascist dictators who'd kept the terrorist groups in check. Notably, Muammar Gaddafi had never permitted al-Qaeda to get a foothold in Libya, and of course Saddam Hussein had largely kept it out of Iraq, though it wasn't the Arab Spring that removed him. The autocracies were in many ways like chemotherapy. They poisoned their countries and caused pain to their people, but at the same time kept the cancer of terrorism at bay. I think a reasonable discussion could be had about whether the affliction or the cure was worse. Either way, when the Middle East stopped its chemo, al-Qaeda metastasized. Taking off my DNI hat briefly to address the big question of the 2012 presidential campaign, I believe that calling President Obama soft on terrorism was ludicrous, but it was very legitimate to ask if terrorist ideologies were on the rise. In fact, with my worldwide threat assessment testimony that spring, I'd indicated that the latter was indeed the case. Did this represent an Obama policy failure? I think it's about as fair to hold the intelligence community to the standard of omniscience, knowing a fruit vendor's suicide would lead to the overthrow of long-standing governments throughout the Middle East, as it is to hold the president to the standard of omnipotence, having the ability to stop it. While both are completely unfair and unreasonable expectations, Congress, and to a lesser degree the public, demanded both of the administration in 2012. So here's what bothered me. Dave Petraeus had agreed to write talking points for the House Intelligence Committee, and the CIA properly coordinated them through the interagency process. As that happened, the White House political team saw the talking points, added a political spin, and then sent out Susan Rice to 5 Sunday shows. Rather than merely sharing the intelligence perspective, Susan was using the talking points to defend the policy of the sitting U.S. president against his opponent in the final stretch of an election. The intelligence community had effectively and unwittingly written campaign materials. We suddenly found ourselves open to attack and to having our motives questioned. On the same day that Ambassador Rice appeared on TV, Senator John McCain was out rebutting her, claiming that the attack had been planned months in advance. He found a pithy line and repeated variants of it several times. It was either willful ignorance or abysmal intelligence to think that people come to spontaneous demonstrations with heavy weapons, mortars, and the attack goes on for hours. There are two factual errors with his statement. One, there were three short attacks, one on the State Department facility, another on the CIA annex a couple of hours later, and a third on the annex after 4 hours or more of silence, not one sustained attack lasting all night. And two, no one brought heavy arms to the first attack. Rocket-propelled grenades came into play hours later, and the attackers didn't bring mortars into play at the CIA annex until 7 hours after someone had first stormed the gate at the State Department facility. So he was wrong. Unfortunately, we discovered we'd gotten a critical fact wrong in our initial assessment. There had been no protest outside the gate in Benghazi. It was a reasonable mistake, given that a crowd had gathered at the gate before rushing inside. But because the original talking point fit the narrative from President Obama's campaign, when we updated our assessment, we were accused of initially lying for the political benefit of the president. I grumbled to my staff that if we were going to be held to the standard of perfection in our initial assessments, then Congress would simply have to wait until investigations were complete before receiving any information from us from then on. On Thursday, September 20th, just 9 days after the attack, Secretary Clinton, Deputy Secretary of Defense Ash Carter, JCS Vice Chairman Admiral Sandy Winfield, and FBI Special Agent Mark Giuliano, who had just become the special agent in charge of the FBI Atlanta field office after serving as the head of the FBI's National Security Branch, and I, briefed all the House members and then all the senators on what we had learned. By that point, we had seen the security camera video from the State Department facility and could say for certain that the incident lacked all the hallmarks of a carefully orchestrated terrorist assault. It was very hard to tell initially who were the actual attackers, and who had then walked onto the compound to join in. The attackers had wandered around haphazardly and didn't seem to know the ambassador was on the compound. We laid out in great detail what we knew, what we thought, and what we didn't know. I stressed that while there were many things we didn't know, we could say with certainty that the Benghazi incident was not a carefully orchestrated terrorist attack planned months in advance. Even after our briefing, though, some Republican lawmakers continued to insist that it had been a coordinated terrorist assault, similar to the 2008 attack in Mumbai, in preparation for which the gunmen had trained and coordinated for months to execute a precise, lethal mission. Their narrative was that the Americans in Benghazi had been under siege from heavy artillery and mortars for hours as al-Qaeda-led terrorists assassinated the ambassador. Senator Saxby Chambliss told me afterward that it was the worst intelligence briefing he'd ever attended. Senator Bob Corker said he'd spoken to witnesses who'd been on the ground and that we'd gotten it wrong. That day, Secretary Clinton announced that she was appointing an accountability review board led by Ambassador Thomas Pickering and Admiral Mike Mullen, both recently retired, to investigate what led to the September 11, 2012 tragedy. I designated a recently retired senior career CIA officer who had led the Directorate of Operations, the Humint Collection Service, as the IC's representative on the board. I knew from my experiences investigating the attacks on Khobar Towers and at Fort Hood that determining the precise conditions that led to the attack was impossible. I also knew the board would have an even more difficult task than we'd had in 1996, because it could obviously not interview Chris Stevens, who'd made all the decisions that had placed him and his team on the ground in Benghazi that night. Still, I felt we had assembled a board of public servants with rich experience and whose integrity was beyond question. We just needed to give them room to investigate. I spent the final week of September in Australia, meeting with my counterparts from the Commonwealth nations, the UK, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, and being honored with a rare award from the Australian government for my more than two decades of promoting the intelligence relationship between our two nations, recognition that was both touching and humbling. On the plane back to Washington, I caught up with what was happening in the States, reading media clips about the hapless, hopeless, helpless, inept, incompetent DNI who'd acknowledged publicly that the intelligence community didn't instantly have a God's eye, God's ear certitude about the events in Benghazi. I considered turning the plane around and going back to Australia. On October 9th, I spoke to the 2012 GEOINT Symposium in Orlando. I had no desire to insert myself even further into the politics of the situation, but I felt I couldn't avoid saying something about Benghazi. Instead of sharing my own thoughts, I referenced an article Paul Pillar had just published on nationalinterest.org. Paul had been the deputy chief of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center, and we'd taught together at Georgetown. As I told the symposium in Orlando, Paul's article so resonated with me and so succinctly captured the balance and perspective that I believe all three institutions of our system, the executive, the legislative, and the fourth estate, the media, need to bear it in mind. I went on to quote his article at length, noting, first and foremost, the seemingly endless public rehashing of the attack in Benghazi that killed the U.S. ambassador and three other Americans is not taking a form that serves any useful purpose. The loss of the four public servants was a tragedy. The rehashing does not alleviate that tragedy. I highlighted the four main points he'd stressed. The first was diplomacy, parenthetically, like military and intelligence service, is a dangerous line of work. There is an inherent tension for diplomats between doing their duties well with everything it entails regarding contact and exposure in faraway places, and living and working securely. Second, hindsight is cheap. One always can construct an after-the-fact case that any one such incident was preventable. This is not the same as saying that such incidents in the aggregate are preventable. Third, resources are limited. Threats are not. Even if U.S. diplomats consistently opted for living securely over doing their jobs well, total security cannot be bought. Second-guessing about how more security should have been provided at any one facility rather than any of dozens of others elsewhere that did not happen to get attacked this time is just another example of hindsight. Paul's fourth and crucial point. Information about lethal incidents is not total and immediate. The normal pattern after such events is for explanations to evolve as more and better information becomes available. We would and should criticize any investigators who settled on a particular explanation early amidst sketchy information and refused to amend that explanation even when more and better information came in. A demand for an explanation that is quick, definite, and unchanging reflects a naive expectation, or, in the present case, irresponsible politicking. As we approached Election Day, the attack had morphed into the Benghazi scandal. By then, the conspiratorial narrative on cable networks and internet-driven news sites held that President Obama and Secretary of State Clinton had knowingly left the State Department vulnerable to a plot by al-Qaeda and had then called off the rescue teams. Further, it claimed that the IC was complicit in a cover-up. I ascribed all of this to desperate political maneuvers and hoped it would go away after the election. On Tuesday, November 6th, President Obama won re-election handily. On December 18th, the Accountability Review Board released its report, finding flaws in State Department security decisions and assigning fault without demonizing anyone. It also lent no credence to any of the conspiracy theories that had been circulating, In February 2013, Clinton, as long planned, resigned as Secretary of State and was succeeded by Senator John Kerry. Susan Rice, who had unjustly become a favorite political punching bag after her television appearances the past September, anticipating that a confirmation hearing would become a circus, had pulled her name from contention for the post, and President Obama named her to replace Tom Donilon as National Security Advisor. In a sane world, the House and Senate might have each quietly conducted an investigation to review the State Department Accountability Review Board's conclusions. But Washington post-Benghazi was no longer a sane political world. Over the next 4 years, investigations were undertaken by the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, the House Committee on Foreign Affairs, the House Committee on the Judiciary, and the House Committee on Armed Services. Finally, in May of 2014, 20 months after the attack, Speaker of the House John Boehner commissioned the House Select Committee on Benghazi. Each of these Republican-led committees attacked Hillary Clinton, who everyone assumed would be the Democratic nominee for president in 2016. The House Benghazi Committee released its report on June 28, 2016, less than 2 weeks after Clinton secured the nomination. Matt Olson and I spent a great deal of time briefing these various committees, describing what happened that night based on the garbled and contradictory accounts of eyewitnesses and evidence from the security camera, Predator, and cell phone videos. NGA produced three-dimensional depictions of the State Department facility and the CIA annex, including the routes between the facilities along which the State Department and CIA people had fled. Our presentation, particularly the security camera video of the looters and vandals, was compelling. When we shared it with the president, he felt it both debunked the myths surrounding the attack and helped him visualize what had actually happened. I urged that we declassify the presentation, publish it, and publicly answer any questions it raised, but the White House and Justice Department pushed back, fearing it might jeopardize future prosecutions. In 2014, U.S. Special Operations Forces captured Ahmed Abu Qatala, the leader of Ansar al-Sharia. In November 2017, he was found guilty of providing material support to terrorists and of 3 other charges and acquitted on 14 others, including counts of murder. I hope that people who are interested in the truth will one day have a chance to see our presentation, including the security and predator videos, NGA graphic projections, and our reconstruction of events. None of the congressional committees ever rose above political narratives to objectively and dispassionately investigate what had happened at Benghazi. Matt and I were always asked if the attack was terrorism, and we always answered yes, it fit the definition, but that was a very low bar to clear. Terrorism is an ideologically motivated attack on civilians intended to intimidate or coerce them into a certain course of action. The attacks on the State Department facility and the CIA annex fit those parameters, which is why President Obama referred to them as an act of terror when he spoke about them publicly on September 12th. But defining them as terrorism is not the same as saying that Al-Qaeda was behind the attack. I don't believe there was any real connection between Ansar al-Sharia and Al-Qaeda before September 11, 2012, although Al-Qaeda was all too eager to claim them after they struck a blow against the infidel Americans. Beyond that, the mere fact that it was an act of terrorism does not justify the need for 8 separate congressional investigations. During President George W. Bush's administration, 12 separate incidents met the same definition of terrorist attacks on U.S. diplomatic facilities. More than 60 people died in those instances, and none of them generated much congressional interest. So I have a hard time believing the investigations were ever really about getting to the truth of what happened in Benghazi. And there's another reason why I don't think the investigations were about discovering the truth, or, just as important, about determining what should be done to keep anything like Benghazi from ever happening again. At no point in any of these congressional briefings were decisions made by Chris Stevens questioned. Given the circumstances of his death, Chris effectively became beyond reproach. While I admired Chris, I still have some serious questions about the decisions he made at that time. Why did he remain in Benghazi hours after the U.S. Embassy in Cairo had been overrun? Why did he go there on 9/11 in the first place? And why didn't he realize his security was completely inadequate? Confidence in oneself and one's team is admirable, but had he become too complacent? If Stevens had survived, those questions would certainly have been raised if the committees were serious about arriving at the truth. And if the committees were really interested in the truth, they'd have asked those questions anyway. The events of that night were absolutely tragic. There is only one reason why the intelligence account of the events remains controversial, and I still feel angry as I write this, 5 years after the attack. The singular reason why we as a nation haven't been able to learn from the tragic events of September 11, 2012, and move forward wiser and safer, is that a skewed version of the events perfectly suits a particular political narrative that arose at the end of a contentious presidential election, because one political party realized they could continue to benefit from manipulating the facts, and because certain people valued politics over objective truth. All of that became possible because on a Sunday morning, 5 days after the attack, the sitting president's campaign opened the door to politicizing intelligence, and because those who should have known better, senior intelligence officials like me, didn't recognize what was happening in time to stop it. Chapter 7. Consumed by Money. The 2004 law that established the DNI outlined three primary tasks for the position. The DNI was to be the senior intelligence advisor to the president and the default leader of the intelligence community. My work in those two roles garnered the most public attention, but I and the ODNI staff put a great deal of time and energy into the DNI's third job, determining the budget and resources that went to the intelligence agencies through the National Intelligence Program. Federal spending on national security tends to grow or shrink based on how threatened we feel at any moment. The same year I became DIA director, 1991, the Soviet Union dissolved, and the defense and intelligence enterprises began to reap the peace dividend. I've written about how I was asked to cut DIA's budget and workforce by 20% over a period of 5 years, how the trend of percentage cuts extended beyond my time as director, and how those reductions were affecting every agency and military service, as well as the Secretary of Defense and Director of Central Intelligence. After September 11, 2001, the cash flow valves reversed, budgets surged, and what defense services and intelligence agencies and elements didn't receive in their base budgets, they got from Overseas Contingency Operation funding. OCO is above-the-line war funding and not subject to the normal budgetary processes. Every type of funding was expanded each year, which we can now discuss because Denny Blair and then I declassified the IC's top-line annual budget number. By fiscal year 2007, the government's fiscal year runs from October 1st until September 30th, the Strategic National Intelligence Program, determined by the DNI, had reached $43.5 billion, and the operationally focused Military Intelligence Program, determined by the USDI, had reached $20 billion, for a total of $63.5 billion spent on intelligence. By fiscal year 2011, the first full budget year of my tenure as DNI, the NIP and MIP had jumped to $54.6 billion and $24 billion, respectively, $78.6 billion in total, which was more than was allocated to all but two or three cabinet departments. By way of comparison, the overall defense budget jumped from $335 billion in fiscal year 2001 to $625 billion in fiscal year 2007, and $717 billion in fiscal year 2011, more than doubling in a decade. Considering those two decades of intelligence budgets, or at least what I can say about them in an unclassified context, I would point to a fiscal reality that makes some people in Washington uncomfortable. According to the Federal Office of Management and Budget, in 1992, the fiscal year of the Soviet collapse, the U.S. government spent $290 billion more than it received in taxes, a deficit the government had to address by borrowing through issuing bonds. With the peace dividend, we spent less on defense, and as the national economy came out of recession, the deficit fell each year of the 1990s. By 1998, the federal government was actually collecting more from taxes than it was spending. And in 2000, it had a budget surplus of $236 billion, meaning it could afford to pay off some debt principal without borrowing more. After September 11, 2001, as defense spending rose and markets fell, the federal surpluses became deficits again, reaching $464 billion by 2008. Then, as illustrated brilliantly by Tim Geithner in his memoir Stress Test, driven by the subprime mortgage crisis and financial institutions' lack of liquidity to use for recovery, the U.S. financial sector and U.S. economy collapsed into the worst recession since the Great Depression of the 1930s. In 2009, President Obama inherited President Bush's commitment of $700 billion to bail out the financial sector and rescue the economy through the Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP. The deficit for 2008 more than tripled in 2009 to $1.41 trillion as the federal government brought in far less money and spent far more on defense, bailouts, and protecting people who were losing their jobs and their homes. No other government on earth spent as much as $1.41 trillion total in 2009. The magnitude of what the federal government was borrowing had become so large that by 2010, when I became DNI, Mike Mullen, then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, characterized our national debt as the most prominent threat to our national security. During President Obama's first year in office, he faced a situation in which he desperately needed to inject money into the U.S. financial system to prevent a second Great Depression. At the same time, almost as desperately, he had to scale back federal borrowing. It was a time in which we needed to address the fiscal realities we faced, removed from the mire of partisan politics. Unfortunately, in 2009, Congress was still populated by many of the kind of people who had, 6 months earlier, staged a juvenile walkout in protest of the briefing DNI Mike McConnell and I had given on President Bush's changes to Executive Order 12333, which redefined intelligence authorities after the establishment of the DNI. Also, unfortunately, when approaching cuts, many members of Congress felt strongly and uncompromisingly that while the budget did need to be slashed, the programs they supported should be protected, whether those were allocated to defense, largely supported by Republicans, or to domestic programs, largely supported by Democrats. Despite the fact that the federal budget makes headline news constantly, few people know how the process actually works. So it's worth taking a few moments here to present what I hope will clarify some of the intricacies of how the budget cycle is supposed to work. During the first week of February, the president presents his budget request to Congress. In a functional world, after receiving this request, House and Senate budget committees draft a budget resolution that offers broad guidelines for the rest of Congress to use in constructing the actual budget. Then, congressional oversight committees spend the next few months critiquing the president's requests, checking items of particular interest to their committees or to their individual members, making backdoor deals, and marking up the request to become House and Senate authorization bills, literally authorizing federal departments to run their programs. Committees also use these authorization bills to conduct oversight. In the wake of the Iran-Contra scandal, Congress made the passage of intelligence authorization bills contingent on the CIA's informing the chairs and vice chairs of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees of any covert actions it was conducting. In my time as DNI, Congress extended this oversight to micromanagement levels, which included informing me of the precise size and makeup they wanted for the Office of the DNI staff, caps on staff pay and promotions, skill sets, and how many desks in Liberty Crossing could be occupied by contractors. Between April and June, committees hold budget hearings, at which executive branch secretaries and directors, like the DNI, defend the budget requests they submitted in February. Intelligence budget briefings are conducted behind closed doors to allow discussion of the details of classified programs. In June or July, the committees release their draft authorization bills to the executive departments for comment. Typically, when Congress sends over the authorization bills, executive departments only have a few weeks to respond, so budget and programmatic experts typically read the draft bills in late-night sessions over delivery pizza on the day they're released. Department headquarters offices send the draft bills with specific questions around to staff experts to get feedback on what provisions and budget lines they can and can't live with. Their responses are then submitted to Congress. Sometimes departments feel strongly enough about their objections that they recommend the president veto the bill unless changes are made to it. A vetoed authorization bill can have serious consequences for a department, including not being able to start any new programs if a bill never gets passed. So in the organizations I directed, we always took recommending a veto very seriously. Again, in a functional world, committees consider the feedback and objections they've received from executive departments, and the House and Senate counterpart committees come together to meld their bills into mutually agreed-upon legislation, which they send to the president's desk for signature. When the president signs the authorization bill, it becomes law, the Authorization Act for that fiscal year. That's not quite the end of the process. Once oversight committees authorize federal departments to run their programs under a specific budget, the appropriations committees, one each in the House and Senate, appropriate money to be spent. That appropriation is the actual federal budget. There are 12 appropriations subcommittees, so the budget can be doled out as 12 separate appropriations acts, or several can be rolled up into an omnibus act. That budget cycle process is the basis for all federal spending, and for the intelligence community, it's even more complicated. IC equities get spread out into two authorization bills, intelligence for NIP equities, and defense for MIP equities. But its appropriation comes through just the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee. There's a reason for this odd arrangement. After congressional investigations determined that the CIA had spied on Americans and engaged in other illegal actions during the Watergate era, Congress decided it required better oversight of intelligence activities. It therefore created select intelligence oversight committees in both the Senate, 1975, and the House, 1977, to oversee the national-level intelligence program. At the same time, in the Senate, it left oversight of intelligence work that supported military operations in the Armed Services Committee. That's how we ended up with a national intelligence program determined by the DNI and authorized by the Intelligence Authorization Act each year, and a military intelligence program overseen by the USDI and rolled into the National Defense Authorization Act for all military activities. To further complicate matters, the Senate committee oversees only the National Intelligence Program, NIP, while the House committee also has jurisdiction over DOD's Military Intelligence Program, MIP. So every year that all three bills passed, we received three sets of instructions/guidance from Congress. And every year, the priorities of the appropriators differed from those of the authorizers. The IC can't spend money unless it's both appropriated and authorized, which caused annual headaches. If we didn't get an appropriation act, we'd shut down. If we didn't get an authorization act, they'd send us the draft bill from each committee and tell us to consider what they would have passed if they'd agreed to pass it. This is how I learned that Excedrin pairs well with martinis. Intelligence budgeting is also more complex because of the types of things we have to budget for. If we want to develop, build, and launch a satellite system with new capabilities in 10 years, we have to plan in which years the development will require more or less funding to stay on track. If we're growing an online capability, we have to plan for when additional staff will be needed to make it work. We need to know whether that funding will come from the NIP or the MIP, and have to trust that congressional appropriations will be stable and support our careful plans. Much of our effort at USDI and DNI was accordingly focused on study and planning for years in the future, rather than what we were currently executing. With all of that as background, I took my oath of office as DNI on August 9, 2010, and as a general indicator of just how well Democrats and Republicans were working together on Capitol Hill, when October 1, 2010 rolled around, it marked the start of the sixth consecutive year that the intelligence community would operate without an authorization act. It also marked the fifth consecutive year that Congress failed to appropriate a government budget by the beginning of the fiscal year. Starting in 2007, Congress had started each fiscal year by passing a continuing resolution, which essentially was the legislative branch telling the executive branch departments to continue operating temporarily at the same funding level as the previous year until Congress could see its way clear to actually fund the government. For each of those previous 4 years, Congress either passed a series of continuing resolutions or, eventually, an Appropriations Act. As much as congressional members complain any time the intelligence community comes up short on anything, Congress consistently failed to do its one primary job, fund the government. The 2010 elections were marked by the rise of the Tea Party faction within the Republican Party, which was a backlash to Obama's presidency. Driven by their victories, the Republicans took control of the House of Representatives, and the newly elected Tea Party members made it a point of pride to be even more purposefully disruptive than the previous Congress. The bright spot for the intelligence community, amid so much dysfunction on the Hill, was the January 2011 appointment of Representatives Mike Rogers and Dutch Ruppersberger as respectively the chair and ranking member of the Intelligence Committee in the House. They were determined to set aside partisan politics and do what they believed best for the IC and for the nation, even if their actions drew the ire of their respective parties. When, in 2015, I presented an award to them on behalf of an intelligence industry association, I said I'd been told that sometimes on a single issue, Ruppersberger, the Democrat, would be taking heat from the Obama White House at the same time that Rogers, the Republican, was under attack for supporting the White House. Rogers and Ruppersberger introduced an authorization bill for 2011 in February, nearly halfway through the fiscal year, and worked with Senate Intelligence Committee Chair Dianne Feinstein and Vice Chair Saxby Chambliss to get it to the president's desk. President Obama signed it on June 8th. Subsequently, Rogers and Ruppersberger worked with the Senate Intelligence Committee to pass authorization bills for each of the next 4 years, which they served together. Thanking them on behalf of the intelligence community in 2015, I joked, "In their 4 years as HPSCI leaders, they passed 5 intelligence authorization bills, 5 annual authorization bills in 4 years. That really only works with congressional math. On the appropriations side, however, the math was not working. Democrats and Republicans seemed to concur that federal spending was unsustainable, but couldn't agree on much else. So in 2010, for the fifth straight year, they failed to pass an appropriations bill by October 1st. On September 29th, 2 days before a potential shutdown, Congress passed a continuing resolution funding the government through December 3rd. The next CR went through December 18th, with successive ones coming on December 21st, March 4th, March 18th, April 8th, and then April 15th. None of those continuing resolutions was passed with more than 2 days to spare before the previous resolution expired, and some were passed only a few hours before the government would have to shut down. Because agencies in the executive branch required days of preparation for a shutdown, across the government we had to prepare again and again to close up shop. 7 times between December 2010 and April 2011, we canceled training and called people back from travel. 7 times we started procedures for closing down infrastructure systems. More than once, we got so close to shutdown that NSA prepared to phase down some non-urgent systems related to signals intelligence. 7 times we notified employees they were hours from being furloughed, sent home without pay for as long as the government remained unfunded. Instructions from the Office of Personnel Management complicated the situation, as we were required to divide employees into 2 groups, those whose work was essential to keep the government from actually collapsing, which included such positions as security guards protecting our facilities, analysts monitoring terrorists trying to board airliners, officers deployed to combat zones in support of warfighters, and of course, people who could answer whatever questions Congress had as they debated passing a budget, and those whose work was allegedly non-essential, including, for example, acquisition professionals who made sure satellites were delivered on time and within budget, officers who coordinated with foreign intelligence services, recruiters who hired new intelligence officers, and the human resources folks who made sure we all got paid. The actual policy document uses the words accepted and non-accepted, but it was all communicated to employees as essential and non-essential. It was demoralizing for intelligence professionals to be characterized as non-essential and then threatened with the possibility of not being paid. Media headlines repeatedly asked, if those people were non-essential, why did we employ them in the first place? The news for essential employees was actually worse, as they would have to work without pay. After previous government shutdowns, Congress had passed a bill retroactively remunerating people for time they missed, but the Tea Party Republicans indicated publicly they would now block any retroactive payments. At the end of the workday on Friday, April 15, 2011, Congress hadn't reached a deal to pass a budget or a new continuing resolution, and we expected to shut down at midnight. We informed people definitively whether they were essential or non-essential. We told the non-essential employees to take home any medication they had at work or anything else critical to their personal lives. By some miracle, though, Congress managed to pass an actual appropriation for the remainder of the fiscal year, and we remained open. In fact, we needed our chief financial officer and her staff to come in to work on the weekend to figure out how the enacted appropriations affected the intelligence community. It was actually good news for the National Intelligence Program, which was given a $1.5 billion increase, our last up year in the post-9/11 streak. But the MIP saw a $3 billion reduction for its fiscal year 2011 funding. Because April 15th was more than halfway through the year, and we'd been told to operate under the assumption of the previous year's funding levels, programs funded under the MIP had the remainder of the year to absorb the $3 billion cut rather than a full year. So instead of an 11% cut over a full year, it was a 24% cut over 5.5 months. As my dad would have said, this is no way to run a railroad. This was just the start of the 2011 drama. The United States is one of only a handful of nations that sets a limit on how much money its government can borrow, and other nations that do either fix their debt ceiling as a percentage of their GDP so that it naturally rises over time, or set a hard limit so high that they don't worry about ever reaching it. In contrast, the U.S. Congress regularly has to raise the ceiling for the amount of money the U.S. Treasury is allowed to owe in bonds. After 9/11,